years ago, psychologists found a guy who was a retired pilot. He was in his like late 60s. He was, you know, highly functioning cognitively, but he had some sort of, some kind of scarring or something on his brain. They did some kind of little minor operation. And he came home to his daughter's house, and she went off to work, and she came back home, and he had torn apart all the televisions because he said the audio and video were not in sync. And then she started speaking to him. If you said hi, he would hear the hi and then see the lips move. So he then realized it wasn't the television that was out of sync, but it was him. It was like a 250 millisecond delay that was conscious to him between the audio and the video. He was, you know, running slightly out of time.
We'll just get started. Hello and welcome to Hear Less, in the podcast where we ask smart people stupid questions inspired by video games. I am your host, Brendan Caldwell, if I can say my own name, and I am here to underhandedly teach you things through the lens of popular games. This time we're talking about Deathloop, which is a shooter about being stuck in a time loop on an island filled with really terrible, awful people, just complete reprobates. So this episode is all about time and the physics and philosophy of time. We're shortly going to be talking to a professor who understands those things a little deeper than me or my guest co-host. So if you
don't know me, man.
I'm guessing you're not a physicist. So if you ever wondered why we can move through space in all directions, but we can only move through time in one direction, for example, keep listening. Maybe you'll find out from our expert. But first, that voice that you just heard is my guest co-host this month. It's games journalist and fellow word mercenary, Nick Rubin. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so good. I said it twice. There we go. Yeah.
You are a freelancer of repute.
Well, in that I'm still eating.
If anyone hasn't read your work, where do you write for? What do you do? Tell the people.
I suppose you probably find me on RPS at least once a month in some form. Occasionally in The Guardian, for some reason. PC Games N quite frequently. They're all my regulars. And then otherwise just sporadic over the place for whoever decides they want to pay me.
You've played a fair bit of Deathloop.
I've actually played quite a silly amount of Deathloop, considering how short it is. Let's just quickly look this up on Steam.
You're typing in my podcast. Ugh. I have to edit out these typings.
No. Apparently, according to Steam, I've played 67 hours of Deathloop, and it's maybe a 15-hour game, and that is a result of me playing it twice normally and then going back and like actually routing it for speed runs, which I don't usually do with games. So I feel they definitely hit a trick there. I think it invites speed runs, or at least kind of says, you know, we know you're not a speed runner, but maybe you'd like to kind of try a few things.
Before we go into this any deeper, could you set the scene for our listeners and maybe tell them, what is Deathloop? What's it all about? What are you doing it as a player?
Yeah, so Deathloop is a first-person shooter from Arkane Studios, with the sort of immersive sim elements that you might expect from Arkane, Dishonored, and Prey. They're a bit lighter in this, and the focus is a bit more on gunplay and kind of immediate gratification rather than planning things out too much. There's also kind of a rogue-lite element to it, in that the time loop is a single day that you repeat over and over again. And very early on, you get the ability to, it's called infuse, you can infuse your gear. You spend a resource called residium to keep your guns and your trinkets that give you special powers from day to day. It's both kind of less smart than it thinks it is, but also it kind of knows that it's less smart than it thinks it is.
What
kind of invites you to enjoy that fact as well.
The time loop itself, like, how does that fit in?
The idea is that to kind of beat the game, you have to assassinate, is it 8 targets?
Yeah, 7 to you.
More than 5 targets in a day, in a single 24-hour period, to break the time loop and escape, because they're all, like, tied to the time loop via some techno babble that's vaguely explained in the notes somewhere, but you don't really have to pay much attention to. And that is presented early on in the game as that it might be a kind of Hitman thing where you plan out all these kind of really elaborate procedural murders and stuff and get things just right. But it actually turns out to be more of a read the note and follow the objective marker. You just poke around on computers and notes, you know, until you get everything in place. With that aside, it doesn't really delve into the philosophy of it too much. It's more just about offering you a kind of repeating playground with which to perfect your own death loop, your own murder party. I call it Murder Party Island.
The way I think of it is that if Fire Festival got caught in a time loop,
yeah,
that's basically what would happen. Well, even if the time loop is not incredibly like deep philosophically, we do like to take things, very stupid things, very seriously on Hail Essence. So we wanted to know why a time loop would be impossible, for example. Why traveling into the past can't happen. It sounds stupid, but there's got to be a physical reason for that, right? Beyond, you just can't do it. So I asked Professor of Philosophy Craig Callender, who has written plenty of books on the subject, all about the nature of time. And so here he is. But yeah, for starters, could you please tell the listener who you are and what you do for a living?
Hi, I'm Craig Callender. I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego, and I'm also a director of the Institute for Practical Ethics. My main research area, sort of what's buttered the bread through the career, has been the physics and philosophy of time. And so I have a few books and many papers on time and time and physics, the direction of time, time travel, why you think the present is special, and all sorts of things.
We're playing a game called Deathloop right now, where the hero is thrown back in time by 24 hours every day. Of course, in reality, time only moves forward. It seems silly for me to ask, but why is that? Why does time only move in one direction?
Well, it really depends a lot on what you mean by time moving in one direction. In particular, there's two things that I think are relevant. One is what people call the direction of time. You know, aging only happens in one direction. You know, so this has to do with the second law of thermodynamics and the fact that the entropy of the world is increasing in one direction. But the other thing it might be meant, when we tend to talk about, you know, time, we're going through time, then that's implying that there's something that's moving through time, which when you think about it, doesn't really make that much sense, because if you're moving through time, then movement is itself a temporal thing. So you quickly get into, you know, philosophy land, because you start wondering, you know, well, if I'm moving through time, you know, what speed am I moving at? And then people say, well, 1 second per second. And then other people then say, well, if it's 1 second per second, then you could cross out the seconds because they're in the numerator and denominator. And so then you're just moving at the speed one nothing, which then doesn't seem to really make sense.
Time passes, the world loops, and you're back in your body by morning. But what happens in between?
Hyper-temporary body reincarnation.
The way I think about it is, you know, what's really moving through time is just sort of your conception of us. You're telling a kind of story, the story of Brendan, and you're building that story with ingredients from the past, from memories, and you tend to think of yourself as unchanged through time, but really there's just, you know, different Brendans at different moments, but you unify them all, identify them all, and so it seems to you like it's moving, even though it's not really.
We got really deep
really fast with that question.
I'm gonna try and keep up. Are there competing theories of time among physicists?
There are competing theories of the direction of time, and there are competing theories of time itself.
I guess what's the big clash?
Yeah, so if we think about, you know, time itself, then there's a big clash between what you might call presentists and sometimes the block theory or eternalism. So on the one hand, you know, you think of the present, you know, this moment right now that we're speaking, you think of this as really special. And some people want to say, you know, what explains it being so special is that it's the only thing that exists. The world is just these three-dimensional spatial objects existing, and then they go out of existence and new ones come into existence. So the future is not there yet. The past is gone. It's all just the present. So that's called presentism. And then on the other hand, you have this other view called sometimes eternalism, or sometimes it's called the block theory, where the world is just this big block. And on this kind of view, time is like space. And so just as you know, I can't see you, you're in Ireland, I'm in San Diego, but you still exist, I still exist, but we're, you know, far apart in space. On this kind of block view, it's the same way with other events in time. And so the event of your birth, the event hopefully far, far away from now, the event of your death, they're there on the block. Just like Ireland is there on the block and California is there on the block. And they're all just there, so mapped out in this kind of 4D map. And so it all exists, doesn't exist now, just like Ireland doesn't exist in California, and California doesn't exist in Ireland, but they're all there, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's a huge divide between different people on time. And so there's some physicists and some philosophers who go with this presentist theory, which clashes with relativity. And then there are the blockheads. And I'm on the blockhead side, although I think that to some extent the two theories are actually intertranslatable. But if you put a gun to my head, then I'm going to be a blockhead.
Sometimes people bend the rules, and sometimes they break them. Dr. Bundy read the rules, then lit the rules on fire.
She's a brilliant scientist. Aren't they always brilliant? That's why they're scientists.
Do those differing theories of time given to us by physicists fit with what we experience as time day to day?
That's what I wrote a book about. I wrote this book called What Makes Time Special. When you think about your psychological present, A, it's all in the past. What you're experiencing right now is a bunch of audio from me. By the time you've heard it, it's already happened. But you somehow assembled this psychological present, and you never experience what's actually like simultaneous with your experiencing in any way. And there's a lot that goes into it in terms of the cognitive perceptual systems, you know, that give you the sense of the present being present. In fact, people disagree about what's present. And so I don't think that these sort of physics of time things actually explain at all what goes into making the experience present, experienced.
So what you're saying is that if I clap my hands in the moment of the clap, that's the present to me. That's my intuition. But my brain and my senses are take so long to catch up. The present has already gone by the time I've done that.
That's right.
So it's hard to pin down where the present even is.
It really is. Suppose you snap your... So I just snap my fingers. If I was physically present to you, you would see, you know, light bouncing off my hand and then hear sound coming out of the hand. Now, when were the light and the sound simultaneous? But that is, what did you see when you heard the snap? And you would find that there are some people who would hear the snap sort of at the, there are light firsters and sound firsters. And so some people will actually see, they'll process the snap, and the processing of the light and the sound will take different speeds for different people. And so some people will, you know, when your finger hasn't yet hit the fatty part of the thumb, will hear it. Other people, it will be after it's been on the thumb for a little while, will hear it. Of course, in ordinary life, you never notice this because, you know, it'd be crazy to think that snap noise didn't come from that person snapping their fingers.
So what happens when you break the loop? Seriously, I want your theories.
Everything goes back to normal, obviously.
Normal? You have absolutely no idea what will happen.
True, but I know one way to find out.
Sometimes it's helpful to think of this example where not quite 10 years ago, but about maybe 8 years ago, psychologists found a guy who was a retired pilot in the UK. He was in his like late 60s. He was, you know, highly functioning cognitively, but he had some sort of, some kind of scarring or something on his brain. They did some kind of little minor operation, and he came home to his daughter's house, and she, you know, went off to work. I mean, he was recuperating there, and she went off to work, and she came back home, and he had torn apart all the televisions because he said the audio and video were not in sync. And then she started speaking to him. I think he would hear you say, like, if you said hi, he would hear the hi and then see the lips move.
Oh, what?
So he was out of it. So he then realized it wasn't the television that was out of sync, but it was him. When his daughter started speaking to him, it was like a 250 millisecond delay that was conscious to him between the audio and the video. He was, you know, running slightly out of time, which is interesting. And then what was super interesting about the studies is that it showed that about a third of people in a lab context with little flashes on the computer and little clicks could also notice the gap consciously. And so we're all running around with this gap, but you just don't really notice it so much in life.
You can't even remember how the f*** you've done.
I've never been a cannibal.
You sure? Even on your worst day.
That's the past, baby. I am a man of the future.
That's like a hard example of, time that's experiential. Time that is almost tracked by us and our brains. Does that fit then with what physics says time is? Is there objective time outside of what we see and hear?
That's right, yeah. So physics needs an objective time. Yeah, so when it's giving you a law of nature about how fast some particle is going, you know, that is relative to a particular measure of time, which is singled out by those laws, really. But you can map all of that psychological stuff onto that physical time.
I sometimes hear people saying things like, time is just an illusion, man, or you know, that's just a human construct, dude. If someone says that to me, can I say back to them, no, that's nonsense. There is a physical reality to time.
Yes, you should definitely say that. If you think of something like Newtonian mechanics and free fall, so, you know, you throw something out of a plane, it'll eventually reach a maximum velocity, you know, it'd be like 32 feet per second squared or something like that. And what does that mean? It means it's defining the second, right? So it's telling you a second is how far those things all will travel. Or maybe you could just take the definition of a second anyway, which is like so and so many billion transitions of a cesium atom. And, you know, that is objective, right? So
I'm going to have to take your word for that one.
Well, suppose we were both playing this video game, you know, we were playing it for an hour. And so an hour would be so and so many transitions of the cesium atom. Now, it might be that to you, the game is really exciting and the time seemed to pass really fast, really quickly. And to me, it you know, dragged on maybe. Yeah, so we would both be having our different subjective interpretations of an objective duration of time. So yes, there's definitely an objective measure of time. Well, you couldn't make sense of any physics, really, without it.
I just killed you!
You did, technically, but you also didn't. It's kind of hard to explain without complex diagrams.
How many versions of you are there?
Versions, not really the right term.
We have this idea, I guess, in our normal everyday lives that the past is set. That can't be altered. That's stuck. But the future is open and changeable. But considering what you're saying about this block universe, and about the nature of space and time, is that just a bad idea? Is the future, what I'm asking is fate an empirical likelihood?
Right. Yeah, so I think no, but then, yeah, so there's something that's genuinely true about the fact that, about this kind of idea that the past is fixed and the future is open. And that is that you have your causal abilities tend to go in one direction versus the other, right? So there's plenty of buttons I could push that would get me, you know, that would change the location of my death, but there are no buttons I could push or mess around with that will change where I was born, right? So you've got this causal asymmetry, and so then there's a big question about where this thing comes from. And so a lot of people, you know, appeal to the thermodynamic arrow of time and say that this is the cause of the causal asymmetry. But about this kind of idea of fate and that, you know, so this comes up often when you think about time travel, right? So people say, well, if you could time travel into the past, could you change anything? And I don't know if this is the time to talk about time travel at all, but...
Please feel free, because I don't know if I'm going to understand it in any other way.
So people say, well, if you went into the past, could you change anything? And on the block universe conception, you could change things if that's the way that they actually are. you can't make things that are not on the block on the block, and you can't replace things off the block. But it might be that the reason things are, the reason the block is the way it is because you did things. But it might be, but that doesn't mean I can't do anything. It might be that I have to go back to make things the way they are.
Sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It couldn't have been any other way, no matter what you do when you time travel.
Yeah, in a sense, people have this idea that you could like go back in time as long as like nobody noticed or you did only small changes. But that's ridiculous if we assume we're on a block universe type of model.
I have a life worth remembering in here.
This isn't life. We're running in circles, killing time.
Philosophers then divide up like all these different video games and science fiction stories and films and that into consistent versus inconsistent models.
Ah.
Where the inconsistent ones are things like Back to the Future or that, where you have two realities happening. But you can't have two realities happening on the block. There's only the block.
What's an example of a consistent time travel in a movie or a show?
12 Monkeys, the original movie, is the perfection of a consistent one. I don't know if you saw that with Bruce Willis and Madeline Stowe. And Bruce Willis has to go to the past. And, you know, I guess it's such an old movie.
It's you okay can spoil to do a spoiler. It. It's been a long time.
Yeah. And so his actions end up causing the dark future that ends up causing him to have to go to the past. But Terminator 1, of course, is another example where Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, he's sent from the dark evil future by whatever that AI that took over is. And then he goes back into the past. And then if you remember, his like a piece of his arm is left behind. And then that technology that created the dark evil future actually came from that arm. And so all that information existed in a kind of causal loop through time. No one ever invented that technology. It just existed timelessly in this kind of loop. But it's all consistent. There wasn't like one universe where there was the dark evil future and one where there wasn't. It was rather just the one block.
In the game, in Deathloop, the player sometimes comes across these other selves, other versions of their own character. It's not really clear, but I guess the idea in the game is that these are different timelines that is happening.
That's right. It looks like a kind of multiverse type of...
Yeah, is there a basis in science for that kind of idea, or is that ridiculous? Should there only really ever be one block?
Oh, no, so if you then add quantum mechanics to the mix, then there are people who subscribe to a kind of many worlds version of quantum mechanics, where these different options trigger different worlds. And then you can think about time travel in those scenarios, which really gives me a headache. maybe that German show Dark might be an example of that, where there you have time travel and multiple worlds.
Yeah.
I don't really like it. It's too complicated.
Craig Callender, thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you, Brendan. That was a lot of fun.
That was Craig Callender, professor at the University of California, San Diego. If you want to hear a longer version of our chat in which we went over time and the rules of time travel a little more deeply, you can get that by subscribing to Hey Lesson on Patreon. For $2 a month, you get unabridged interviews with all of our experts. That includes the 20 plus experts we've already spoken to in previous episodes, so not just Craig. But also, if you sign up for other tiers, you can get bonus episodes, one of which Nick and I are recording shortly about Hitman. So if there are any subscribers listening, keep an eye out for that. Just head to patreon.com/heylesson to find out more, or click the links in the show notes. So Nick, cards on the table, having listened to what Craig told us, are you a presentist or a blockhead?
That part was, I thought, was really interesting, especially as in regards to the game. They're literally called eternalists, aren't they? Which was the kind of more scientific term for blockheads.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering then, is Colt a presentist? Oh, God, it's a weird one. It's hard. I'm not actually sure. You'd have to ask me on the day. because I think in like hokey old philosophy rather than sort of actual good science, the idea of the presentists that Craig brought up, it reminded me of Heraclitus, the old Greek philosopher. And he said, no man ever steps in the same river twice, for it's not the same river and he's not the same man. And there's also a concept in Eastern philosophy. I was going to say Buddhism. I'm not quite sure if it's actually Buddhism, but that's the concept of one meeting. You only ever meet people once, because every time you meet them, you're both different people.
I'm going to be a blockhead just because the science people say blockhead. So I'm just going to, if it goes against Einstein, I kind of feel like, oh no, he's too big to go against.
Yeah, no, for sure. I guess, all right, last bit of hokey philosophy for the moment. You've got the Nietzschean idea of like the Apollonian and the Dionysian, right? Or like the kind of the romantic self and the logical self. So I guess my romantic self is a presentist, and I kind of like presentism. I feel like there's quite a freeing notion in that. It's quite empowering actually as well. But my logical self, yeah, well, I'd have to be a blockhead. And also it just screams logic, doesn't it? Because you've got like a square shaped head. the flowy flouncy presentist, like with their wavy bullshit. They come crashing against the hard edges of your blockhead.
Those presentist hippies.
Exactly. And you just repel them with staunch bastion of pure logic. Maybe that's the dichotomy that that Deathloop is kind of setting up.
It doesn't really go into this stuff at all, though, does it? I mean, like Deathloop, the game, its story is... I mean, the reason that you're in a time loop is something to do with the island just has a kind of weird anomaly, and there's a science reason behind it.
Oh, but for sure. Although it does make me wonder, you know, I mean, the multiplayer is so influenced by Dark Souls, if maybe they took some of the kind of more storytelling chops from Software as well, and you can read basically nothing through the whole game and still have a fine time, or you can kind of piece together Colt's entire history and why he's there from the notes and the conversations you have with past cults, if you want. So I feel it does a really good thing, which is giving you, like, presenting a world that is interesting enough to think about, but doesn't bog the minute to minute down in sort of, you don't have like a kind of version of cult who pops along every day and explains.
And this is the lore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it kind of lets you go into the lore as much as you want. I thought I understood most of what Deathloop was, and then someone wrote up a timeline of events and I read through it and I was like, I did not get half of this from the notes that I found.
I looked it up as well and I was like, I definitely learned some more stuff that I didn't pick up on. The weirdest of which being, that kind of rang a bell again from the chat earlier with the expert, was the study he brought up about the pilot who was in his daughter's house and then started having a weird time lag experience. And I just thought, I'm not saying that they'd heard of that at all, but I'm saying that a writer could feasibly write Deathloop from those kernels, couldn't they? Or
yeah,
at least maybe there's a spark there. But I thought it was really interesting as well about the idea of the subjective and the objective can of course like work together, because you have two people subjectively experiencing an objectively measurable thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like you give one person a chili and you give another person the same chili, and you can tell them there is, what is that capsaicin like? The Scoville scale. Yeah, you can tell them this is this on the Scoville scale. We've measured the amount of capsaicin in this or whatever it is that makes it spicy. And one person can eat it and go, yeah, that was pretty spicy. And another person can eat it and start crying and sweating.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting. You can map subjective things onto objective things. Like they don't need to be mutually exclusive.
No, for sure. I wish I'd have known that when I still smoked weed, actually. I could have had some much better conversations.
All right, well, here's a smoking question then. If you were caught in a time loop, would you necessarily go on a killing spree?
It wouldn't be my first instinct, no. No, I see myself much more as Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. It's just ordering these just obscene tables of cake, and that would get me by for at least 100 years, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote about this recently in an article. You said that the best bit of time loop fiction is the bit where the nihilism kicks in and the hero just does wacky stuff like ordering loads of cake or stealing from the bank.
Yeah, for sure. I do some bank hold-ups. I definitely hold up a bank. Except you'd have to get a crew together in, like, the morning. And you'd have no time to like, lay those connections down. So you couldn't ring up the guy that you hadn't seen for 10 years. Yeah, it'd be a montage. But yeah, I'd definitely hold up at least one bank. I think that would be fun.
Tell me a bit more about how you feel about the game generally, because you told me the other day that you had some bones to pick with the game, and I said, I told you to leave it for the pod, but we're here now, so what's up? Pick them bones for me, please.
I think I already kind of brought up kind of my main disappointment with it, which was that the kind of vaunted time loop that you have to quote-unquote solve is literally just a case of reading things and following map markers. And then you even get like a kind of a death loop last day series of map markers to follow as well. So, and I assumed it would be more like, again, maybe more like the Outer Wilds or Sexy Brutale, or just something a bit more puzzle based, a bit more where more could go wrong, or there would be more things that were like appealing, like dropping Alexis in the meat grinder, that kind of drew you towards them because they'd obviously had their own bespoke kind of design put into, but then turned out not to necessarily be the right way. And there is an element of that. Every Eternalist has kind of got their standard loop and then their alternating loop, basically. And their standard loop is usually wrong, and their alternating loop is usually right. But there isn't much more than that. But maybe I'm asking a bit too much from it. And the other thing was that I just didn't, there just wasn't as many moving parts as in Dishonored 2. So for a game that takes the reins off, the wagging narrative finger, as I called it, from Dishonored and says, you know, go crazy, it then doesn't give you as many like toys to go crazy with.
You mean like the powers and stuff? Because yeah, in this game, a lot of the powers from Dishonored kind of carry over, like the blink one where you can teleport a little bit, or the domino one where you can like connect people's minds together and then you shoot one and the everyone you've connected together has died. But there are visibly fewer powers in Deathloop than there are in Dishonored.
Yeah, exactly. And also you can like move items around with your mind in Dishonored, so you can like hurl grenades, or I mean it's the classic ImSim thing. If you have like a bunch of verbs and they work together in unexpected ways, and there's just fewer verbs, I think, in Deathloop. All that said, though, I still spent 67 hours on it. And considering that Dishonored had one gun in it and Prey had two guns in it, or maybe a few more than two, but they weren't really guns as much as they were tools. They were just sort of enemy deleters that you could point at them. To come from that to make a first-person shooter with the guns that feel that good, as they do in Deathloop, is astonishing. And I think they worked, I think they had a hand in one of the Wolfenstein games. So maybe they sort of picked something up there. But yeah, that's one of the things that stood out to me the most for the game. It's just like, they'd literally never made kind of technically a first-person shooter before, and that's their first FPS. And it feels great.
The shotguns, I'm a big fan of. Even the most basic, like, I forget what you call it, a puncher or something.
Yeah, yeah.
The most basic enemy shotgun that you pick up.
It's awesome.
It's just a nice thwomp to it.
I really love the 4-pounders, and there's a version of the 4-pounder you can get off Harrier that shoots toxic gas. I call them the fart pounders. And you can get double fart pounders. And also you can get a trinket that makes Colt restore health when he's around toxic gas. So that's...
Oh, so you just like shoot the floor and then walk in.
Yeah, yeah, fart gas. Yeah, you just fill whole rooms with fart gas and you're just walking through it basically invincible. Unless someone shoots a gun and then the whole room explodes because you're not invincible to that.
Yeah, that is the other thing. The 4-pointers you're talking about are like these, they're like these big Colt Magnum looking things almost, yeah, yeah. But they have nice flat edges, and it's like a common multiplayer gun, isn't it? Because the multiplayer invasions, if another player invades you, if you shoot them with this gas gun and they immediately shoot back, they basically blow themselves up.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot. There is some really fun tricks. I mean, one of the shotguns, yeah, just switches between the two as well. I do love the game to pieces, I really do, but it's just not It's just not perfect. So I got a niggle.
Do you prefer then the Dishonoreds? Like, or do you have a preference?
I guess it depends what mood I'm in. No, I had more, like, I respect Dishonored more as a game. I think it's probably more interesting, but Deathloop's far more enjoyable. And considering they had, I mean, Arkane had two commercial failures in a row, didn't they? So I can completely understand why they'd want to kind of open up the formula and make it a bit more accessible to people.
Which are the commercial failures? Is that Dishonored?
Dishonored 2 and Prey were both flops.
I keep hearing this, but I don't actually know the numbers behind it.
I think Prey only sold like 1.5 million copies.
That's enough. That's fine.
It feels maybe, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, they're still going, aren't they? So
yeah, they still sell all the time. Like, they're all always out there. I don't know where this idea of them being flops came from. I think maybe Bethesda just wanted more profit than they got.
Oh yeah, no. It would be. It completely would be that. Yeah, that's the like the Square Enix thing where they sort of they aren't happy with 6 million copies sold. But I don't know. That seems to be maybe it is just a prevailing narrative that I'm parroting. But I did. That's kind of from what I've looked into it. I know that that neither of them did that well, or as well as someone had hoped.
All right, we're gonna leave it there with the Deathloop, unless you have anything more to add. Like, you have any burning thing you must tell the listeners about Deathloop, Nick?
Okay, yeah, actually, there was literally one more point that I wrote down, which is that, because I've just written this whole piece, you know, saying that basically without Dishonored's morality system, you know, that's what allows for a lot of the fun in Deathloop. But I just realized that, like, well, partly because of your guest talking about entropy earlier, and that's kind of how the morality system in Dishonored works. Which is, you know, it invites more chaos, it's more entropy, the city falls to pieces. But obviously Deathloop is stuck in a loop, so there can't be any entropy. So it could actually realistically have, like, Deathloop's world could have this exactly the same morality system as Dishonored, but we just would never know about it. There's a chance that, yeah, if Colt was a and then he breaks the loop and he wakes up the next day and there's just rats everywhere crawling all over everything, in the beer, in those nice burgers. So yeah, that was my big brain realization.
That was the galaxy brain moment.
Exactly.
Cool, we'll leave it there. This has been another episode of Hey Lesson with me, Brendan, and our guest this week, Nick Rubin. Thank you very much for joining us, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Is there somewhere people can find you on the internet? You're one of the clever people who stays off Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was a hard-learned lesson, but I'm on LinkedIn if anyone wants to connect in a very serious business sense.
Don't do that.
No. No.
Don't join my professional network on LinkedIn on the podcast.
Don't do that. In fact, just cut that out. I don't actually want people to join my professional network. I thought it was a joke, but then maybe it's not a joke. You've made me feel like I've committed some massive faux pas here by even mentioning
it's like an internet faux pas. Nobody talks about LinkedIn. We all use it, but we can't talk about
that's
it.
That's honestly how I felt for a second. The best place for people to keep up with me is literally just to read Rock Paper Shotgun regularly, because I'm on there quite regularly and can come have a lovely chat with me in the comments. That's it. That's my internet presence.
If you at home have enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us. Regular donors get extra episodes, like I mentioned, but you also get to rest easy knowing that this podcast is staying ad-free. And since we've been talking about the passage of time, this episode, I should say, marks 1 year of Hey Lesson. It began in October last year, so we're officially 1 year old now. So let me just take this chance as well to say to everyone who's kept us going by supporting on Patreon, my beloved Fact Rats, or if you're simply listening along, you're all the reason that this keeps going. I literally couldn't afford to put in the work for every episode without you, so a massive thanks to all of you. An extra big thanks to Bok Choi, Horrendamonas, and Milk is Gross and Bad for You, my special triumvirate of Patreon heroes. But for now, one final thank you to you, Nick.
Thanks.
Whacking off the mute. Are you vaping? Are you vaping, Nick?
Considerably.
We're going to stick around and record a bonus episode on Hitman. If you're a subscriber, you can check that out soon. But for everyone else, goodbye. And as always, thanks for listening.